Hello, I'm Montse Alvarado. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
My office, we found that Planned Parenthood's language was quite misleading.
Court actions and legal disputes. An attorney general claims his state Supreme Court made unprecedented moves to get abortion on the ballot.
When you read a surrogacy contract, you understand that it's the exploitation of women.
The alarming realities of surrogacy brought to the forefront during a meeting calling for an end to the practice worldwide.
The pillar of the pro-life movement in Kansas, or some would say the lion of the pro-life movement, for his years and years of advocacy.
Decades of fighting for the unborn, a U.S. archbishop is honored for his work fighting for life.
With today's decision, millions of Arizonians will soon face an even more extreme and dangerous abortion ban than they did before.
Uproar from the Biden administration and pro-abortionists after the Arizona Supreme Court upholds a law limiting abortion. The law bars abortions except in cases when it is necessary to save a pregnant woman's life. Those who aid in abortion, violating the law, face 2 to 5 years behind bars. Previously, Arizona law limited abortion to 15 weeks. Right now, there is a stay or a legal hold on the ruling. While it is a win for mothers and the unborn, there is an extreme pro-abortion amendment that has exceeded the signature threshold to be put on the ballot in Arizona. The measure would permit unrestricted, unregulated abortion at any time in pregnancy and removes safety standards like parental consent, informed consent, and inspections of abortion facilities. Montana may also see a ballot initiative to cement a right to abortion in its state constitution. After being caught up in legal action for weeks, the state Supreme Court finalized language on the measure that is backed by Planned Parenthood of Montana. The Law and Justice Interim Committee is reviewing the initiative on April 18th, but since the petition is already approved by the Supreme Court and in the signature gathering phase, it's unclear if a committee review will impact the measure. The Attorney General in Montana, Austin Knutson, worked to block the ballot proposal for abortion. He joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show. First, can you walk us through all of this legal back and forth? Your office deemed the initial proposal legally insufficient, saying that it had contradictory language and a couple of other hurdles. The Montana Supreme Court then reversed that decision. Can you explain why you thought the original proposal was insufficient?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. So the big reason we found it legally insufficient is that Montana law is very clear on the on these voter initiatives, these constitutional referendums. They can only be single subject. And we found that the Planned Parenthood language, because that's who pushed this referendum, it log rolled. That's the term that we used. They wrapped several issues into that one initiative, and they're trying to log roll, so put too many topics on the ballot at one time. That we found was legally insufficient. Apparently, that didn't apply in this case, according to the Montana Supreme Court. They overturned that. At that point, my office we found that Planned Parenthood's language was quite misleading. Frankly, it was quite flowery and vague. So we rewrote the language for the ballot with very factual, very very dry factual statement of what that language would actually do. Again, the court didn't like that. Planned Parenthood didn't like that. So they took the extraordinary step, the Montana Supreme Court, of number one, rewriting the language themselves, but number two, deciding that they could bypass the step of going to the legislative committee and just send this right out for signature gathering before the legislature had a chance to even look at this. That's unprecedented here, but apparently that's what happens when Planned Parenthood funds your election campaigns to the Montana Supreme Court.
Now, what recourse do you have then, knowing that there really is a violation of the processes and also the true separation of powers even at the state level? Is there an appeal that you have in mind should this go through and continue?
Well, at this point, I mean, we don't have an appeal. The Montana Supreme Court is our highest state court of appeals. in the state. We've been to them a couple of times here. They've made very clear that they want to help Planned Parenthood get this thing out and get them to signature gathering. If there's an action to be taken here, I think it's by either the voters of Montana or possibly by the Montana legislature.
So then abortion really is legal in Montana until viability if you're under 16. What does the parental notification reality look like?
Well, this is a really interesting one. So clear back in 2013, Montana voters by almost 3-1 approved a voter initiative that required parental consent, not just notification, parental consent. That tells you that 75% of Montanans agree with that. That was challenged clear back in 2013 by Planned Parenthood. The Montana Supreme Court, to no one's surprise, blocked that. The ones who are really out of step here with Montana is clearly Planned Parenthood and the Montana Supreme Court. But with this proposed initiative, the way they've got it drafted, yeah, it would block any parental consent, parental notification. I mean, my daughter can't get an aspirin at her school without my consent. But if this crazy voter initiative passes, they're going to say that she can have an abortion without me even knowing about it, without my even notification, let alone my consent. That's completely out of step with your average Montana.
And it's out of step with your average American. Is there anything else that you have that Montanans should know as they approach the ballot box?
Well, I think it's really important for them to know just how extraordinarily the extraordinary measures that the Montana Supreme Court took in this case to get Planned Parenthood's ballot initiative out for signature gathering. I don't think they would bend over like that and go to such extraordinary measures for any kind of right-wing organization like the NRA, maybe a pro-life organization. I don't see it happening. I mean, Planned Parenthood spends a tremendous amount of money funding these justices' campaigns for election and re-election in Montana. And that's what I think Montanans need to know.
Well, it looks like you've got some investigative work to do there to bring that to light a little bit more. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks.
EWTN News is tracking the ongoing changes in abortion laws across the United States. Take a look at our interactive map on the laws and what states are going to have abortion on the ballot by visiting CatholicNewsAgency.com. Workers are now entitled time off to obtain and recover from an abortion. Finalized federal regulations under the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, published this week, included abortion with other pregnancy-related conditions. It does not require employers or their health plans to cover the costs or pay for that time off. Regulations go into effect in June. In England, some 87% of babies prenatally diagnosed with Down syndrome in 2021 were killed by abortion, according to statistics released by the National Health Service of England. Those numbers, recently released in March, came as an amendment to bring the abortion time limit for babies with Down syndrome to the same limit for babies without disabilities was tabled. Currently, abortion up to 24 weeks is legal in England, but if a baby is thought to have a disability, it is available up to birth. Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer has legalized paid surrogacy in her state. Earlier this month, she signed a bill repealing a law that criminalized paid surrogacy with up to a year in jail or a $10,000 fine. The new laws effectively commercialize the practice. Whitmer says the laws protect families seeking in vitro fertilization and LGBTQ+ parents. Pope Francis calling for a universal ban on surrogacy in January, and the document released by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith in April have brought greater attention to the practice. The Catholic Church is not the only entity raising awareness on the moral, ethical, and medical concerns of the renting of wombs to produce children.
We're not used to hearing the bad aspects of surrogacy and how it's totally unethical.
Born of a surrogate, Olivia Morell is now leading the charge to ban it.
As a child born from surrogacy, I've suffered from abandonment issues, identity issues, because I was abandoned by my mother at birth, and I was ripped away from her at birth.
She shared her story at an international conference for the universal abolition of surrogacy at the Lumsa University in Rome.
The meeting aimed to promote an international treaty to outlaw surrogacy. The conference came only a few days before the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith published a comprehensive document on moral questions regarding human dignity. That included gender, abortion, and surrogacy among them. A paragraph in Dignitas Infinita, or Infinite Dignity as the document is called, says surrogacy is considered a grave violation of the dignity of the woman and the child, based on the exploitation of situations of the mother's material needs. A child is always a gift and never the basis of a commercial contract. Many couples would argue surrogacy is the only way they can have a child. But Jennifer Lall, the founder of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network, refutes that argument.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to couples who can't have children, and they desperately want children. But I would respond by saying, but that doesn't give you the right to risk another woman's health, and that doesn't give you the right to buy children.
While surrogacy is banned across most countries in the European Union, the practice is permitted in the majority of U.S. states. That's a big problem when it comes to international law, according to Swedish journalist Kajsa Ekis Ekman.
Well, what they need to know is surrogacy is basically violating a number of international laws and moral laws because it's about the industrial and intentional separation of mother and child. So unlike adoption, where, you know, technically there would be an orphan that would need a family, here you actually have a mother who's fit enough to carry out a pregnancy and who's still around, but she's not allowed to be with a child, and the child is not allowed to get to know her.
Emma Waters, Senior Research Associate in the DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation, has written about and studied surrogacy. Thank you so much for joining us, Emma. Data on the health risks and for surrogates and for the babies is much more prevalent. A C-section is 3 times more likely with surrogate pregnancies, and surrogate babies are 5 times more likely to be delivered at an earlier gestational age than non-surrogate babies. And of course, preeclampsia, hemorrhage, and miscarriage are higher for surrogate pregnancies. How can doctors justify supporting this or rectify their support for this?
Yeah, this is a classic example of, once again, a driving ideology, the right to a child or a desire to it for a child, overruling even what we know of medical outcomes when it comes to the well-being of the surrogate mothers involved and the well-being of the children involved. Something that most people overlook is that surrogacy, as it's commonly practiced in the United States, requires the use of in vitro fertilization. And so even in vitro fertilization, we know that children born from this practice have higher rates of cancer, autism, congenital heart failure, and other issues that really do affect the quality and well-being of their life. And for the mothers involved, they are 5 times more likely to actually perish as a result of the pregnancy or of the labor and delivery. So it's a really it's really bizarre to justify this practice when we know that medically, the women and the children are the ones who are paying the price for others to have the child that they desire.
Now, Emma, you talked about the physical medical realities, but in your research, you also have discussed the medical psychological impacts of surrogacy on the mother. Is this similar to the trauma of a miscarriage? And have you found any impacts that are psychologically significant for the surrogate children themselves?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. And I would say for the surrogate mothers, by and large, of the women who have spoken out about this, what they report is something far worse than a miscarriage. So in a miscarriage, it is the tragic loss of a child. But in most cases, women know that they did everything they could to protect this child and keep the child as long as they could. In surrogacy, it's completely different. In many cases, I've spoken to surrogate mothers who go through the pregnancy excited to help a family in need. And yet when the delivery comes and the baby is taken away, oftentimes before they've even had a chance to hold the baby and meet the baby, they experience this just crippling sense of loss. And in many cases, postpartum depression skyrockets. And some have said that not a single day passes, even years later, where they don't think about this child and wonder how he or she is doing, what their parents are like, and if he's safe and okay. And for the child involved, that surrogate mother, even if she's not the biological mother of the child, that surrogate is the only mother that this child has ever known. He's learned the sound of her voice, the taste of her amniotic fluid that actually corresponds with her breast milk, and knows the environment that he's in. So when that child is taken away from the surrogate mother, even if he's placed in the hands of his biological parents, he's placed in the hands of strangers. And so when it comes to the psychological well-being of children, the best that we can say is that we really don't know what we don't know, because only one longitudinal study has been done to actually assess the psychological well-being of children. And it's filled with so many methodological errors that it shouldn't be something that we rely on. And yet the state of New York, the state of Michigan, and countless others have actually cited this single study that was only based on 42 children to say that surrogacy confers no harms to children. But that's just not the case, especially when we know that children born from anonymous egg and sperm donation or children who suffer the loss of their parents through adoption do have these crippling identity issues, much like Olivia mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so to say that surrogacy has no harm really overlooks, I think, all of the data we have on child well-being.
Well, you just mentioned what's going on in the United States. Why is this so heavily regulated throughout Europe, but not in the U.S.? Is there any history there that is not well known about that trajectory of really starting to get protective and walking away from surrogacy in the European Union, as you know, conversely, we're doing the opposite here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on here. The first is that in the United States, many women who are serving as surrogates are from the middle class. So while there is a perverse financial incentive for surrogates, they're oftentimes women who are not typically very poor and are oftentimes not minority women. In Europe, on the other hand, the surrogacy class, the women who serve as surrogates, are oftentimes from very poor villages in Ukraine, Georgia, and other impoverished areas who may or may not even know how to read, not know the quality of the contract that they're signing. And so I think a lot of Europeans have really risen up against this practice because it does exploit some of the most vulnerable women in all of Europe. And secondly, for better or for worse, the feminist movement has been very opposed to surrogacy. And so in Europe, the way feminism guides the policies that they put in place has actually been a far more powerful force than we've even seen in the United States, such that you have many leaders on the basis of their feminist values, their desire to support women, actually outright oppose the practice of surrogacy, again, because of the way that it really does take advantage of and exploit these vulnerable women.
Right. You've seen pro-abortion advocates in Europe who are anti-surrogacy. Well, let's turn this to it in a slightly different direction. Let's listen to more of what Jennifer Lahl, who we just heard in the package previous to this conversation, what she had to say about the business of surrogacy.
The global market is in the billions of dollars, and it's a growth market, so it's trending up. It's, you know, predicted to be in the multi-billion dollars by 2025. It's a standard the rich can buy, and it's the poor or the lower income that have to sell. You know, surrogacy is very expensive. A take-home baby can be a six-figure baby by U.S. dollar standard.
Big money means big power. How can you combat that kind of influence?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I think the three things to keep in mind here is, one, we need to have a targeted approach here in the United States that actually taps into the ethos of Americans, which is distinct from our European partners. So the first is to make it clear for Christians of all traditions that surrogacy necessarily violates the unified bond of marriage between one man and one woman by bringing a third woman into that marriage. Even if the man is no longer directly having intercourse with her in order to have a child, they still are bringing a third woman into that unified bond of marriage, sex, and procreation in a way that violates both what the Bible says about marriage, but also what many throughout church history have said. And so I think first and foremost, getting all Christians on board with this beyond just the Catholic Church will be huge. The second is keeping in mind the national security risks. So in the United States, we have probably the biggest international market for surrogacy, bigger than Ukraine, bigger than Georgia. And the number one demographic, and this is coming from the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, a big fertility organization, the number one demographic coming to the United States for surrogacy are Chinese nationals. And typically, these are Asian men over the age of 42. And when a child is born in the United States, they gain and maintain the full rights of U.S. citizenship through birthright citizenship laws, such that when the child turns 18, the parents, even if they're Chinese nationals, have a direct line to citizenship. And so this is a massive national security concern that is totally unregulated in the United States. And then I think the third to keep in mind is the state of New York didn't actually legalize commercial surrogacy in 2021. And the reason they did this was because they claimed they couldn't find any women who were willing to serve as a surrogate altruistically or as a surrogate for free, right, out of the kindness of her heart, which tells us that there is a perverse incentive where even if women do have happy feelings associated with the surrogacy, that the majority of women would not consider this practice unless they're getting paid that $20,000 to $70,000 to serve. And so I think that's a really compelling argument to make that this really isn't about altruism. This is about big business. This is about big money. And if it comes to the well-being of children or financial incentive, liberals and conservatives alike should be able to recognize that there is something far more important here than the amount of money that you're making.
A very serious correlation and one we have to take into account. Thank you so much, Emma.
Thanks.
Abortion may be on the ballot, but pro-life culture is on the streets. We'll bring you the latest state march for life after the break.
Just in Kansas, but in other parts of the country, we have a lot more education that we have to do. And if we can reach minds, change hearts, that'll drive the public policy.
And we sit down with an archbishop who is a lion of the pro-life movement. Kansans, but also pro-lifers across the U.S., may soon see a staunch defender of the unborn retire from ordinary ministry. A Kansas City archbishop known across the U.S. for his strong voice and also well known to our EWTN Pro-Life Weekly viewers will soon reach the age of retirement. Correspondent Alan Holdren caught up with Archbishop Joseph Nauman last week as he received an honor for his tireless work for the unborn.
There's a U.S. bishop who has made it his life's mission to ensure the dignity of unborn life at all costs. Whether marching for life to the steps of the Kansas State Capitol in Topeka year after year, or on the national stage.
For each of our children and for all people throughout the world.
Over the last 20 years, as head of the Archdiocese of Kansas City, Kansas, Archbishop Joseph Nauman has been a leader on the U.S. pro-life scene.
Though he's an adopted Kansan now, his pro-life leadership began in St. Louis, where he was born, raised, and ordained. It came up providentially when his name was somewhat randomly proposed to head the diocesan pro-life office.
Said, well, I really feel passionate about this issue, but I haven't even been the moderator of the pro-life committee in the parishes where I've been. So I said, I'm not sure I'm really qualified for this. And he said, I need three names. You probably won't be chosen. So I consented again. I've always felt if I could do something in this area that I desired to do it.
He caught Pope St. John Paul II's attention and was appointed an auxiliary bishop of St. Louis before being named to the Archdiocese of Kansas City, where, just as John Paul II, he has been a model of the outspoken defender of the defenseless, with the fight against abortion at the forefront of his mind. He even chose John Paul II's words, life will be victorious, as his episcopal motto.
Yeah. I was given the opportunity to be involved with leadership and human rights issue for our time.
The archbishop has been at war recently in the state of Kansas, where protections for the unborn were left exposed after the Kansas Supreme Court ruled abortion a constitutional right in 2019. Abortions have tripled in the state since then.
Our laws don't permit human life to be destroyed in any other context, so it teaches young people, well, this must not really be killing a human life because the law allows it.
And for his leadership in favor of correcting that error, he was honored at this year's Kansans for Life banquet.
Kansas has been blessed by the towering leadership of this towering man, a true national leader who has humbly championed the cause for the right to life throughout his ministry. I give you the 2024 recipient of the Heroic Defender of Life Award, Archbishop Joseph Naumann.
Thanks very much. I'm very grateful for this award. And I believe it really represents not so much what I've done, but what our church has tried to do and what so many others have tried to do. And to be part of the pro-life community has been a great blessing.
After a lifetime of service to the people of God, he'll turn 75 on June the 4th, 2024, which means he'll have to submit his resignation letter to the Pope. And if the Pope accepts his resignation, he's at peace that there's another generation to take up the baton.
This is going to be an issue that we're going to deal with for a long time. I think there's a new wave of pro-life leaders that are emerging. Old people like me, I think there's some really good leaders that are coming up within the church, but in the broader society and culture as well. And they're willing to take risk and bold risk and to confront the lies of the culture. And so yeah, I think the pro-life movement is going to continue to grow, and it's going to continue to adapt to the new challenges that we face. I'm excited to see the fruits of that down the road.
In the Kansas City metropolitan area, Alan Holdren, EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
Well, the Archbishop will certainly be missed. He hopes to continue in active ministry beyond 75, but if the Pope does indeed accept his resignation, he is looking forward to serving the priests and people of the Archdiocese in his new capacity as Archbishop Emeritus. Cheering for the unborn in Denver, Colorado, pro-lifers gathered at the state capitol with their voices united to support our most vulnerable. Signs saying, "Love them both," and "To support mothers with care and compassion," were held by young advocates of the movement. In Munich, Germany, pro-life activists also walked for our most vulnerable. At some points, they did face verbal and even physical attacks from protesters. There were even efforts to block the power supply to the stage, but public utilities quickly fixed it. It didn't stop men, women, and children from celebrating the gift of life and defending the voiceless. 50,000 people took part in a March for Life in Poland. Flooding the streets of Warsaw on April 14th, they raised their voices against legislative proposals that would allow abortion until the 12th week of pregnancy. A touching moment of the march was when the sound of a heartbeat of an unborn child played over loudspeakers. And in Mexico City, thousands are expected to take part in a march on April 27th. The motto, "Without life, there is no future," organized by the Steps for Life movement. This year, the march will also collect donations like baby food, diapers, and financial support to help vulnerable women. Thanks for watching this week's episode. For pro-life news sent directly to you, sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, at EWTN.com/pro-life. And don't forget about the National Eucharistic Congress that will convene in Indianapolis this July. You can get discounted tickets through EWTN. Visit EWTN.com/Eucharist to sign up. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.